Noel, a lot of water has passed under the bridge since, what, Wexford, August 1971, Tuva was your first winner and you were on board.
Yeah, miracle. It kind of half ran away with me, I think. It was funny, he was after running in Galway. We bought Tuva, a pal of mine, a fella called Michael Condor, he's a farmer down the road, and myself bought Tuva off Buster Harty for £100 at in Ballsbridge Sales. He'd been pin-fired. And he was a right little horse. He was a little grey horse by King's Bench. And he didn't win that much, but every time we ran him, he was placed. And of course, we had no money at the time, you know, so I was riding him and that was free. And sure, every time, the races were worth 202.60, I'd say, for second and 30 for third. So, like, it sounds terrible small money now, but believe it or not, like, when you'd finish second or third, you got £60, it was like manna from heaven. Like, people were working for that time for about £7 or £8 a week, you know. So it was incredible. But when we got him, I was riding him, and he was placed a good few times, and then he ran in Galway in the 2.5 mile handicap hurdle, the amateur handicap hurdle. And I remember coming to the last, I just come round the outside of Mouse, was on a horse of Peter McCreary's, and I came up on his outside, and I had just winged the last, and sort of, I looked around to see what's around coming, and Jesus, Mouse got back up and beat me. So I got desperate stick over that, you know, I was beating the neck. So we came home from Galway anyway and decided we'd let him out for a while and give him a break. So we let him out for about 2 weeks and we had a bit of a holiday ourselves. And then we brought him back in for about 2 weeks and went off to Wexford and in an amateur maiden hurdle. And because the 2 weeks out must have done him good anyway, because he bolted up. I think DK was second actually that day, which is a notch in the gun, I suppose.
I imagine you were very stylish, not as a rider.
I was a terrible rider. I was a terrible rider. Funny, early on, like when I was a kid, I would have hunted from here to, I would have went from here to Kildare on a horse, and I would never have looked at what was in front of me. But very early on, I got a fall in a point-to-point in Mullingar, and there was about a full field, and I was first or second over the fence, and I got kicked from one fence to the next. And ever after that, like, you know, you hear people talking about the bottle gone. My bottle was gone then. And there's nothing you can do about it. Like, it's just gone. And when you see jockeys when the bottle goes, and you say, oh, pull yourself together. But you can't, because it's just there. And that. So when I rode the winner, I was, all my pals says, that's well done, no, now give it up and let someone else have a go. So I did, lucky enough.
So that was your only winner?
That was the only winner, yeah. That was the only winner.
And that set you on track for what's been an unbelievable career. You're not too far off 3,000 winners now. And you were very young when you started training. Am I right saying, what, you were 20 maybe?
I was, or even less, I think, because I think I had a licence when I was 19, or in 69, I think I had a permit in 69. And because we had a couple of runners before that, before we got Tuva, we had a couple of other yokes that weren't much good. And Tuva was, not that he was that great either now. He, like in today's terms, he was not a 65 horse, you know. He was a pretty ordinary horse. But to us, he was a Gold Cup horse, you know. But, it all started from there. It was very simple things. We were farmers, and my father had been... I came home from school when I was 16 because my father got sick and he wasn't able to run the place. And I came home... Ben, my other brother, was seven years younger than me, so he was very young at the time. And all the rest of the family were all girls. So I came back to sort of more or less run the place. And sure, I was mad about ponies from the time I was knee-high, even though there's nobody in the family, like on either side, my father and my mother, had anything to do with horses. And but there was a crowd of us around here at the time, myself and the McKeevers, Colin and Christopher McKeever, you'd remember, James Halpin, who was a first cousin of mine, and this fellow, Mick Condra, and a few more, Henry Corbley, who would be he'd be an uncle of our present Minister for Justice. And a few more like that. And we all had ponies. We're all farming people, and we had ponies, and we used to go hunting together. And then we organised race meetings with the ponies. We'd go from one farm to another, and we'd have these races every month or whatever, and we'd put up. We even had steeplechases and whatever was that. It was great fun. It was great fun at the time. So that's how we sort of started. So when we got into the racing, then it was sort of all built on from Tuva. Somebody asked me to train a horse, and I think the first year I had four horses, and I think the year after Tuva, the four of them won, or we had four winners anyway, and it just sort of went on from there. And in 77, I think, Sweet Mint, we had a filly belonging to my brother-in-law. She was by Meadow Mint, and she won at Royal Ascot. So it seemed to bonanza after that. Everything seemed to go well.
And did you start training by accident? Is that fair to say?
More or less. Well, no, I realised there wasn't going to be a jockey, so I had to fight. And I was just horse mad and whatever. But I never went anywhere. I rode out on a Saturday probably for 6 months in Bryce Smith's. Helen McDonough's mother and father. Helen's mother was more the trainer than the father. And well, Helen probably was, John was gone at the time, so it was more Helen and the mother that trained the horses at the time. So I rode out with them on a Saturday for a while. And then I just started training and just picked it up as it was going along, and sort of equated it a bit to sort of human training, you know. But over the years, you picked up different things from different people, and it sort of just came on from there.
It's amazing. All the great trainers, they always refer back to it, that basically they pick up a lot. They look at it from a human point of view, how to train horses. And you're obviously the same.
Yeah, I think you do. I think that you have to look at them, like you have to look at them individually. At some stage, I don't know how. What's it? Now, it would have been well on at the time, but a guy contacted me, an Englishman, and do you know what's funny? I shouldn't remember his name. I can't think of his name now, but he used to work for the British athletics team, and he had ideas about training horses, and he came here a couple of times a month, and he had ideas about interval training, and it certainly did change me quite a bit on the way we start and the way we trained. And what he was telling me about the way the athletes were trained at that time, and that had a big bearing on the way things changed.
And Noel, you're a young trainer, 7 years in the game, go to Royal Ascot, have a winner in the Cork and Ori Stakes. It's dreamlike stuff, especially when you come from a non-racing background.
Oh, sure, look, to be honest with you, Fran, I'll never forget it, because it was very funny. The press came running. It was spilled rain that day. It spilled rain. Mark arrived over, and they were hired the suits to go to Ascot, the runner. And, of course, he had no hat, and he couldn't get a hat. So they borrowed the hat off the porter in the hotel to go to the races. And it spilled rain. I'll never forget that. And they got caught up in traffic. And they came in. They only arrived in barely just in time for the race. And when she'd won, and we were standing in the winner's enclosure, I thought it was easy, you know, because she'd won. And the press were all around me saying, is she going to run in the July Cup? Is she going to run in the July Cup? I didn't even know what the July Cup was. What's the July Cup? I hadn't a clue what they were talking about, you know. It's amazing, actually, how it transpired after that. But she was a lovely filly. Seamus McGrath had a very good horse at the time called Ballad Rock, a sprinter. And that she had some great tussles with him. And I remember she got running when she was running in the Phoenix Park. They had at the time, a bandstand on top of the tote building. And they used to have the Artane Boys band up on top of this. And they'd play, you see. And this Sweet Mint was very highly strung. In fact, to be honest with you, she hated me. Absolutely hated me. And tried to kill me on numerous occasions. But when the band would strike up, it used to drive her bananas. You know, like, I mean, she'd start booking and kicking the parade when she ran in the park quite a bit. But I remember one day when I had the deal done with the fella that he wouldn't play when this race was on. And the next thing is he struck off and I ran out of the freighting, ran round up the steps. Funny that's what they stopped anyway, whatever. But we had some great tattoos in the park with Ballad Rock and whatever. But she was just, sure, looking back at it now, probably... She must have been very, very good. she must have been very, very good.
Wally Swinburne rode her that day.
Wally rode her, yeah. Wally rode her in that day. And he rode her most of the time. He rode her, Wally was riding for Dermot at the time. And he rode her in most of the races. Tommy Carmody rode her a couple of times as well. But Wally won the Scurries on her the year before. And she'd won a few in a row that time. And then... Then the following year she was running in the better races. She'd gone up to the top of the weights and she was running the better races. But look, things happened at that time. We had another. At that time, she was the first two-year-old we had. And the following season, and we had, she was, I think I only had her. I don't think I had another two-year-old. But we had 4 2-year-olds. And I remember bringing them to the Phoenix Park to work them, not to the race course now, to the actual park. There was a very good gallop in the park. And we worked these 4 2-year-olds and they finished, one of them finished a long way ahead of the others. And the second was an awful long way behind ahead of the other two. And anyway, as luck would have it, we went to the races in the park with the two of them. And the lad that had finished second was running the first race. It was a 6 furlong colts race. It was a horse called Camaras. He was French bred. And Benji Coogan was riding him. And I said, he probably hasn't much chance, but so I'd let him do his best anyway, see what happens. But he was slow out of the gate and he didn't get a great run either. And he was beaten head and neck and ahead, he finished fourth. And the one that was after beating him by a country mile and the piece of work was in the next race. And I didn't think, like we were sort of thinking that she was, who a whole lot. So I remember, forget anyway, finding the fellas that owned her, the lads that owned the filly. She was running, she was a filly called La Semana. And I said, Jesus, lads, Smith, I get a few quid on this one. And they said, what? I said, she'll win. And funny, since that day until this day, I never was ever as sure that something would win as I was about her. And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm telling you, this will win, you see. And anyway, she went down and they started backing her 33-1. And I think they backed her from 33-1. They couldn't get any more money on her. They just couldn't get any more money on her. They were fairly heavy enough punters, the fellas that owned her now. But anyway, Peter McAleer was one of the fellas that owned her. Peter was married to his sister, Des O'Malley's. And Des O'Malley was telling me the story after he was minister, one of them, I don't know whether he was justice or what he was at the time, but he was in the ministerial car and they were driving down the west and they used to do a programme called Airs and Races on the TV. Val Joyce, you see. So anyway, Val Joyce came on anyway and he went to the track and Michael O'Hare was doing the commentary and Michael says, there's a big, big gamble in this two-year-old race on a filly called La Semana, trained by a fella called Noel Mead, who I never heard tell of, you see. I don't know this fella, Noel Mead, or whatever. So anyway, he said they were halfway up and Michael was doing the commentary and he says, money or no money, he says, I'm afraid this gamble's gone astray. And then he comes back and he says, I tell you a lie, this has not gone astray. He says, this is going to win. And she bolted up. And it started, the next time she ran at the Curragh. They won a lot of money at the time. I think they were talking in terms of 75 or 80 grand offer, which would have been colossal, absolutely colossal. Whether that was the right figure or not, I don't know, but we had some celebration. I think it went on for a week. But anyway, the next time she ran, she went to the Curragh, and the lads that owned her asked me, would I get, see, could I get Lester to ride her? He was riding for Vincent at the time. Sure, as far as I was concerned, Lester was someone that you saw in the paper, or, Lester Pickett. Lester Pickett wouldn't ride for Noel Mead. But anyway, so I said, fair enough, I rang him up. And we rang him up, and Susan said, yeah, he'd ride it. So he came home. We're standing in the ring. I'll never forget. It was a funny thing. I often told the story after. I stand in the ring before the race, and the two, those three lads, one of them says, how much did he ask for to ride it? I said, he didn't ask for anything extra. Oh, he says, you better tell him there's a bonus in it for if he to win, you see. Like, sure, he's doing his best. Like, the boys are in funds anyway after the park, you see. Anyway, so tell him there's a monkey in it for him if he wins. So anyway, he came in, and I swear, people would tell you about he didn't give Leicester instructions. Well, the only thing he didn't ask me was where she peed last, because he asked me how much she'd eat, would she stay, would she this, would she that, would she the other, and he was going on and on and on and on. And then we walked over to give him a leg up on her, and I said, by the way, I said, there's a monkey in this for you if you win. Right, he says. So off he went, hard held, wins. So we're up in the, I'll never forget, we're up in the owners and trainers bar, and there's champagne corks flying, and everybody's having a ball, including me. Everybody's going well, the whole thing. And I sort of suddenly thought about me, the Leicester's monkey. So I says, what about Leicester's money? And fair play, anyway, 5 £100 notes. I'll never forget it. Peter pulled them out, 5 £100 notes for Leicester. And Peter McAleer used to smoke Monte Cristo cigars. And he pulled out a Monte Cristo cigar and he says, here, give him that for me as well, will you? So I stuck the Monte Cristo cigar in my top pocket, and I had the monkey in my hand, and I was going down to the weigh room in the Curragh to talk to Leicester. Jesus, like, I mean, I was on top of the world, like, I mean. And so I get down the door, and a fella in the white coat stand the door and says, could I see Mr. Piggott? So Leicester came out anyway, and I had the money in my fist, and I handed it to him like that, and he went, nah! And he took the money and was gone. So I was a bit down in the mouth about this, but anyway, I'm walking back up to the celebration, and I suddenly think of the cigar, you see. And I says, I says, I'll smoke it myself. So anyway, then I started thinking, I should have given him the cigar and kept the monkey for myself. But anyway, I gave him the monkey and I kept the cigar and I smoked the cigar myself. So that was fine. On the Monday morning, phone rings. Susan, Leicester said to thank you so much for the money. He was so thrilled. And he said, he'll ride for you any time he can if you have something that's fancied. So we became great pals, and he rode quite a few for me after that. And any time he was, obviously, when he was coming over for Vincent, and if we had something, there was a chance.
Back in the early days, when you were predominantly flat, the great Stephen Crane, as your stable jockey, he came to you after being champion apprentice and was, am I right saying he was stable jockey to you for around 7 years in the flat?
Oh, he was. He was with me for a long time. I got it. I still miss him. He was the best fun, and we had great times together. We had great fun then as well. He used to go off to India every year during the winter, and we're looking forward to him coming back. Himself and Mick left Liam Brown at the same time. Mick went to Michael Conn's and Stephen came to me. And sure, Stephen was, sure, I suppose, if he went to the right yard at the time, he was every bit as good a jockey as Mick. The problem with Stephen was that he talked too much, probably.
Really?
He'd probably tell you that himself.
He invented the word bud, didn't he?
Yeah, bud. Yeah. Yes, bud. I never forget. He had a couple of rides over hurdles, and he had a couple of rides over on a couple of, and I never rode in a chase, but he schooled over fences. Schooled over fences a bit, but I'll never forget. He rode a winner in a filly, a mare called Oakland Beauty in Wexford one day. And he's coming back in anyway. The next thing is, it's very close finish. And he's coming back in, and the next thing they said, this is a visual result. And he says, into number one. And I said, well, no, I didn't win. He says, the judge will be looking. We got the race anyway. I don't know whether that had to do, but he was quick enough to win to number one anyway. He says, we'll go in there first. The visual result, the camera didn't work. But look, I had great times with him. And he was brilliant around Galway. He was really brilliant around Galway. I was a very, very good rider now.
He always, well, in his own mind, he said he was the best jockey ever to ride Galway, wasn't he, Crane?
He told us on the way up today, we were doing a bit of background research, he said that he was definitely a stone well in when you had him, so...
Oh, he was definitely was, like, I mean, there was, like, Mick was brilliant around Galway as well, but so was Stephen. we had some great tattoos over there in Galway.
Racing to the final flight, and Clinchin are coming to join. Hi, Harry. Towery on the near side at the final flight now, and over it. Clinchin touches the front on the far side. Is Hi, Harry, and then the centre, and Towery, and racing into the closing stages. Clinchin is the leader. Clinchin are going away to win the Guinness Hurling at the line. Clinchin from Hi, Harry, the centre, Towery, and then another row. At the last, Northern Sky and Pinch Hitter together from Track Scout. Pinch Hitter the leader now on the run in from Northern Sky. As they race to the finish, Pinch Hitter is the leader. Pinch Hitter from Northern Sky, Track Scout in third, and at the finish, Pinch Hitter is the leader. From Northern Sky in third place is Track Scout, and Ross Fandango fourth ahead of Steel Duke.
Pinch Hitter was one of those, because it was training flat horses. At that time, most of the jumpers I had come from the flat. So they're mostly fast ground jumpers. And Pinch Hitter was, he won two McDonough handicaps and he was beaten ahead in his third one. He won two Galway hurdles as well. So he was a real Galway specialist. He wasn't an easy horse to train now. He used to spend his life, God bless him, in we had a water box at the time, and he used to spend his life in the water box because he had a problem with his suspensory. And for some reason or another, he used to come right for those couple of months through the summer. But you couldn't train him any other time of the year. He'd be, you know, he just couldn't get. We poured thousands of gallons of water on his legs to try and keep him right. But he'd come right for those couple of weeks in the summer, and he won the McDonough as a 3-year-old, and then he won it again as a 4-year-old, and he won the hurdle that year as well. And then the following year, he probably ran the best race he ran. He'd top weight and he got pushed wide. He got beaten ahead. And then he came out and he won the. Janja won the hurdle and beat your dad the first time anyway. I don't know if he beat him the second. No, he beat Tommy the second.
He's still the only horse to win back to back Galway hurdles, isn't he?
I couldn't say that now. I don't know. He could well be.
I think his Anzar might have done the plate and the hurdle, but not in consecutive years.
Yeah. Shorty Leach, did he win a Galway hurdle? Or was it Janja who won both?
No, Janja won them both times. Shorty would have been after that then. No, the first jockey we had, the jump jockey that we had, we had Stephen, and the jump jockey I had at the time was Joe Byrne. Joe was dead now, God rest him. And Joe was champion jockey with me. He probably, God forgive me for saying it, but he was probably the worst. Well, now it'd be a toss up between himself and Tony.
Poor old Tony wanted that.
But Joe wasn't a very classy rider, but he was a very good jockey, if you can know where I'm coming from.
Ride a race.
He'd ride a race. Mm. He'd always be in the right place. Always. And he'd always be in the right place and have the right fella pinned in, and he'd always have the job done to a T. But he was hands like shovels, and he was, and whatever. But he was, of course, he got well known for his beating up of Batista, our first runner in Cheltenham, was beating a short head in the Triumph. And if he only put the stick down, I'd say we might have won, but he got beat by Halen, mind you, I suppose. Halen was a very good horse after as well. But Joe was champion jockey with me, and he was with me for quite a while. And Stephen was here at the same time. He was riding the flat horses at that time.
And was it by choice or by design that you were the king of Galway for quite some time? Yourself and DK had titanic battles.
Yeah.
Your horses ran up multiple successes. Was it a plan to always target the festivals and the handicaps? Was it by design or just by the material you had?
Well, I think it started with Pinch Hitter when he won then. And Galway was like, we hadn't, most of the horses we had were handicappers. So like you were talking about Galway, you did head to Galway. You know, there was a couple of those big races. So it was, that's why we did put a lot of emphasis on Galway. And sure, we went down and stayed down there for the week. And sure, we had a bit of fun and a bit of crack and whatever. Like, I don't think anyone has as much fun now racing as we did then. Like, I mean, it wasn't, I don't know what, maybe I'm getting older or whatever, but we had great fun. Like, we really had great fun at it as well.
Speaking of fun, there's a story I've heard for years, never asked you. There was rumours of a Saab going around the Amnes Road in Galway races after Pinch Hitter won one of the good races.
Stephen Crane and yourself?
There's absolutely no doubt. That's not a rumour at all. That's true. After he won the hurdle and the McDonough that year, Stephen drove the Saab around the track with Finbar Cahill and myself sitting on the top of it the whole way round. And we drove in from there into the Ardalan in Galway and on the top of the car. And we yahooing the whole way in. I mean, as I say, talking with, there were different times, I suppose, like that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore. But that's true, yeah, that happened.
Do you think the fun has gone out of it in that respect a bit?
I don't. Hopefully it's not gone out of it. But it is more professional now. There's no question about that. And like with racing on TV, like everything is analysed to within an inch of its life, you know. And jockeys wouldn't get away with the way they got things they got away with then, now. And I'm not saying bad things, just anything. Like, it's a lot more professional now than it was then. And there wasn't as much racing. And
National Farm, Chemski, they were all other multiple winners in the flat.
Chemski was a very good horse. He was probably, he might have beaten Pinch Hitter in the Galway Hurdle of the Year. He fell at the second last. And he was going really well at the time, but maybe he wouldn't. But after that, he turned it up, and he wouldn't do anything for me. And I remember saying to the owners, I said, maybe you should send him to someone else. And I sort of recommended Billy Byers and to send him up to Strand Hill, because Billy used to do a bit on the, you know, different on the Swift Beach. But they had a different plan, which wasn't as good for Noel, because they sent him to Paddy Mullins, and Paddy revitalised him, and he went and he won all round the place.
Even with Tony Mullins on.
Even with Tony Mullins. I'm only joking. Tony Mullins is a brilliant rider. He even had his two hands in the reins sometimes.
Did he?
Tony, no, I'm only slagging him.
Noel, Steel Duke is another multiple winner for you. He was one of your flag bearers early on in your career as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Steel Duke was the same time as Pinch Hitter. And they, like, I mean, he won the, John Queeley won the GPT on him, and he won the big race on the Friday as well. And then he was very good in Galway, and he won the big race at the September meeting. He won the Basketball Cup in Tralee. He won seven in a row, I think, handicaps in a row. He carried 10-6 the following year in a. Didn't I run him thinking he couldn't get a penalty, because I thought he could, once he was top weight, he couldn't get a penalty. And I ran him in the, you know, that mile and six conditioned race, and he won that. And then he came out on the Friday and we ran him with 10-6 again, and he won again. He won the big race. He was pretty and funny. He had a Steel Duke was supposedly had a bad heart, and I can't think of his name now. He was in the vet in the veterinary college, and he used to come down and check him every so often, because as far as he was concerned, he was a complete one-off. He was belonging to lovely people. A fella still very fond of, Jim McKeown. He lives in Dundalk. A great friend of mine for donkey's years. And Jim got a great kick out of it. And I'm still in contact with Jim all the time. We're all getting a bit older, but Jim had another horse, and myself and a few lads had another horse called Steel Bar. He was quite a good horse as well. He went to Cheltenham for the Triumph, and he fell in the Triumph. He was quite a good horse. But Steel Duke was a very good horse. But funny enough, he was bought as a jumper. He was bought as a Derby sell, and he jumped very well. But he wasn't as good over jumps. He just took too much out of him. And after he won all those races in the handicaps, we ran him in a Group 2 at the Curragh, and he got beat ahead by one of Vincent's, and were, I don't know, a long way cleared the third. And he was never the same horse after. He had a ding-dong bottle for the last furlong, and I can't think of the horse's name that beat him now, but it just killed him, because he just thought he couldn't get beat. But he got beat, and he never got over it. He won again, but he wasn't never the same horse. Up to that, he didn't want to get beat. He was. But after that, he thought. I always felt that race killed him. That the Group 2 race killed him.
Suds or Music.
Oh yeah, he was a good horse. I got a belt over Southern Music. I was in Fairy House one day. It was belonging to a lovely man, Richie. He's dead, Richie McCarthy. And Richie McCarthy used to turn up. He'd arrive down in Turndown Wellies. Richie was worth millions. But Turndown Wellies, arriving anywhere. I'll never forget. He goes into the Curragh one day and he wearing a pinstripe suit. And I says, Richie, you're looking well today. Oh, he says, he was from West Cork. He doesn't know. He says, I'd have a bath once a year, whether I need it or not. But anyway, Southern Music ran in the Benson and Hedges handicap hurdle in Fairy House, 9:13, Shorty Leach. 9:10 even, I think. Might have been 9:10. And we had the top weight in Fane Ranger, who was a brilliant horse. And he had 12 stone. He might have even had 12.7. He had 12 anyway. Anyway, Southern Music beat Fane Ranger. Fane Ranger was second. And there was a huge big jackpot that day. And just when Shorty pulled the saddle off, he says, where's the lead bag? And we left the £5, little small lead bag, in the stable. We were after winning the race before with a horse called Daltmore. And of course, me trying to do everything, had to saddle the two horses instead of letting someone else do it. And I left the lead bag in the thing anyway, so he lost the race. And he was walking out of the weigh room afterwards, and a fella ran up and hit me at home because he thought I was up to it, like he thought he was doing something, and it was because he had him in the jackpot. So it is, yeah.
You couldn't blame anybody else that day either.
No, couldn't blame anybody else.
How did the relationship with you and Paul begin?
Well, Tommy and myself were always good pals, and Tommy wrote a good few winners for me. And we were always good pals, and so we used to have a few drinks together. And he, when Fairy House be on, I'd always pull into Rathote. Tommy had a few pals there, and they're all gone now, imagine. But we'd always pull in and have a few jars with Tommy on the way back. So I'd seen Paul out hunting, because I used to hunt with the ward, and I'd seen Paul out hunting himself and Thomas, his eldest brother. And so I knew Paul from that stage. And then he went down to Jim. And from very early on, from the time he was with Jim, every time Tommy was saying, he doesn't like it down there. He's going to leave it. And I kept saying, keep him there now as long as you can. Keep him there. It's better than a good boarding school. That place is good for him, you see. That place is good for him. Keep him there. Because I knew what he was like, you see. Mm. So he went, this went on for, he must have been with Jim for a year and a half, because he wrote a winner for Jim anyway. And everybody, that partnership was never going to last anyway, I suppose. They were opposites. So that wasn't working. So the next thing, I was in one Saturday evening after racing, and the next thing, he says, he's leaving it. He says, you should tell me if he's leaving it, he might as well come to me as go anywhere else. So not thinking any more about it, the next thing is, I got a call the following morning, he says, he'll be with you tomorrow. So that was straight away, boom, he was leaving. So we had a runner in Sligo that day in an apprentice race. Sure, he might as well ride the horse in Sligo. So of course he bolts up on the horse in Sligo, and that was how it started from there. And he was champion apprentice with me. Now, not that year, but I think the following year. But he was a brilliant flat rider. Oh, my God, he was a brilliant flat rider. Mm. But he had no interest in it. But he was absolutely, his time and everything was brilliant. But anyway, he was here, and he was an apprentice, and sure, he was whatever. And he came, and I'll never forget, I came into the yard one day, and Paul Cullen, who's my head lad, came around the corner, and there was steam coming out of Paul's ears and his nose and his eyes. And he says to me, I'm telling you now, he says, I don't care how good he is. I don't care whose son he is. And I don't care what he is, he says. Either he goes or I go. He says, I don't care that he's doing nothing, he says. But he says, he's not going to keep everyone else doing nothing as well. So I was living before Cheltenham because I was having dinner with Pat Flynn in Cheltenham, and Pat said to me, he says, that Carberry fella seems to be fairly useful. I says, yeah, I think he's quite good. He says, I have a fella that's very good as well. He says, who's that fella called Barry, Shea Barry. And he says, all right, he says, not much of a sweeper, says Pat. You know, Pat's very droll. Not much of a sweeper, says Pat. And I said, all right, not much of a sweeper. What do you mean by that, Pat? He's no good with a brush. So he says, I just keep him doing what he's good at. He says, what's that? He says, keep him on riding horses all day. Yeah. He says, that's the only way to do this. I thought, geez, that's the right way of doing that. I'll try that with my man. So I came home anyway, and I said, right, that's it. Now you're riding from now on. The young horses, you can go nagging them around and whatever in the afternoons. So I went into the yard one evening, and someone said to me, what did you do with Paul? I said, that's what I didn't do unto him. He says, he's sweating. He was riding there at 18 hours or something. He's busy all day. So that went well for a while. And then the next thing is that wasn't going so well because he was going round the country on them. He'd come back after touring. So we had to put ropes across the top of the fences and that. I'll never forget. What was his name? Johnny Set Aside. And when he went jumping fences, God, he was brilliant. I thought, and I said, Paul was riding him at the time. And I said, God, he's very good, isn't he, for a fella that started. I says, I don't know a fair bit with him now when he was a 3-year-old. He'd come from the Derby, said, or a 4-year-old. He said, I don't know a fair with him. He'd go ahead jumping with him now when he was that. So he was very good. He was a very good horse, belonging to a few very good friends of mine. And he won the
Ericsson,
yeah. And dropped dead walking back in after the race. So
yourself and Paul, it was an endearing relationship, hugely successful. He was champion jockey a couple of times based with you. You were at the height of your powers as well. What set him apart to the rest of them?
I should look at him. He was a brilliant rider. He didn't abuse horses, number one. And a lot of the time, people used to think Paul was going real well. But he mightn't be going as well as you think at all. Mm. Paul, I could watch Paul, and I would know watching him that things were, he was starting to squeeze. He'd squeeze them with his hands and his knees and his ankles. Mm. He'd have the life squeezed out of them before he'd have a go for them at all. Yeah. But when he'd go for them, there'd usually be nothing left at that stage, you know. He was incredibly good. But he was just like his dad. His dad was the same. He had a great... I remember saying to Tommy one day, what speed would you go in the National? She had no, he says, she had no. How do you know? Well, you know, you know, and so that was it. Like, Paul was the same, you know, you just go.
It was instinct.
It was total instinct with him. He was just a very, very, very good rider, very good horseman.
Instructions-wise, was that a waste of time?
We gave that hope. That didn't work at all. That didn't work at all. No, I eventually gave that up, instructions, because that was... And, like, to be honest with you, not just him. I wouldn't give... Sure, Fran wrote a good few for me and a lot for me as well. No, I wouldn't give instructions. Like, I tell you, tell them about the horse and tell any of them about the horse. But I wouldn't for the life of me. As I say, I can't ride. Why the hell would I be telling them how to ride? Like, I would say... He stays or he doesn't stay or he needs a good gallop or whatever. But like as to how they were going to do that, or maybe you should hang on a bit, or maybe you should do this, or maybe you should do that. But I'd be very easy as far as instructions. I wouldn't be given a lot of instructions. I think I certainly wouldn't be tying them down, be sixth here and fifth there. Yeah. And like I would see some fellas thinking, I can't understand. There must be. You'd know the fellas that would be giving instructions.
You would, yeah, and you were like that. You'd just give the background of the horse and you'd think that we've done our end of the deal, if you like. But Paul always thought that there must be days that it would frustrate you, you know, like he's so talented and we know that he liked, you know, it's too easy for him on occasion. So for you, Nace one day, wasn't Sally's girl.
That was terrible. That was terrible. Like, I mean, it was. Look, friend, there's no doubt. Like, we're still very good friends, and we are very good friends, but there were some terrible days. Like, that was a terrible day.
They come down to the final flight now, and it's Glazeway in the lead from Sally's Girl, and on the run up towards the finish, Glazeway with Sally's Girl coming back strongly on the far side, and racing now to the final 150 yards, it's Glazeway in the lead, followed home by Sally's Girl. As they go to the line, it's Glazeway who just beats off Sally's Girl by about 3 parts in an eventful Slaney Novice.
To think that he thought he had to go round again, just shows how good the filly was, that the mare was. He thought he had to go round again. Ah, he made some terrible bloomers too now, and that we'll move on.
But the flair, that was the thing.
The flair was there, and Desi and myself were great pals, and Desi always maintained I had £7 in hand when you had Paul riding for you. Mm. I sometimes wondered about that, but no, he was a big help, and he was a good. He could teach them a lot schooling too. Now, after a while, he didn't actually. We only had him in when on schooling days. He really didn't write much work for me or anything after that. He was when he came back from England. He only done a couple of days schooling and that. He didn't write every day or anything like that. So, I do think Paul could have been, if he had Nina's dedication, he could have been a lot better. He could have made more out of himself than he did. Like, he was very good, but he could have been made more.
It's just so easy for him that he didn't have to work at it. Was that the thing?
He probably needed to. Like, he wanted to give up hunting for starters. To be able to win the start every time, every time something come around, he was injured. For I'll never forget, he ringing me up and he said, and it always just coming up to Cheltenham. Well, what? I got a fall. I said, and is there anything broke? Yeah, he said the gate. I'll never forget. We were down in, it was one of the funniest things I ever heard in my life. We were down in Adair at the Champions Awards 1 year, and I think he was champion jockey and I was champion trainer at the time. And Desi Scal was doing the compare, and he said to me, "And what makes Cowbury so good? Paul so good anyway." And of course, your man is down the back, and he lets a roar up his hair on top of everybody. Dedication. One thing, wasn't dedication anyway. But we had good fun. We had good times, all right.
Did you ever try and stop him from hunting? The height of the season.
No, I didn't actually, to be honest with you, because he loved hunting, you know, he still loves hunting, I often wondered after should I have been hard running, but I don't think it would have made a lot of difference really.
You just knew.
Well, I don't know. It's you know, he's Paul is Paul, and that's it. You know.
But it was a partnership that you'd saw. Well,
he was, like there was a lot of times Paul could have ridden other horses in the races, and at the time Limestone Lad. Now, he rode horses for me when he could have ridden Limestone Lad and other horses too, and he was like. I stuck by him, but he stuck by me too. You know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't let me down when. So we it worked out both ways. You know, he was. There's not a bad bone in Paul's body. He just he if he couldn't do you a good turn, he'd never do you a bad one. Mm-hmm. And not everyone you can say that about. But like he is, there's not a bad bone in Paul's body.
Still breaks quite a few of your yearlings,
really,
doesn't
he? Oh yeah, he still breaks a lot of horses for us, and. He's still sort of like, I mean, he's magic at it. You know, he's doing a lot of show jumping now, and he has he has 4 kids, but he has 2 that are show jumping and I think one of them is going to be a jockey anyway.
Casey Lewis,
she's a dinger, Casey Lewis, yeah, the eldest of them. Yeah.
Well, I think LJ might, he reckons LJ is going to be, give Casey Lewis plenty to do.
They'll have plenty of practice anyway.
Plenty of practice,
Noel, on speaking of natural riders, Richard Hughes won an Irish champion hurdle for you, Cockney lad.
Yeah, Richard was a very good rider. He was a good rider. He was, he was, he was, He was a good jump jockey too, wasn't he? He was a good jump jockey. He won on Cockney Lad, yeah, the theatre world. Yeah, he rode good for me. He was coming over and back from England at the time, and he wasn't riding on the flat at that stage, was he?
He took the winter off basically to ride over Jump Sandy. He was riding his song he wrote for you.
Yeah, that's right. Sure, he must have done very hard to keep his weight down. Mm. He's such a tall chap, which is no more than yourself, I suppose.
Yeah, true.
You were about the same size.
Just a natural rider, though, wasn't he? Like, just
he was.
Like an elastic band, he could mould himself.
That's right.
Into
that's
horse,
right.
Just here.
I suppose too, Fran, like probably no more than yourself. He was lucky that he had Desi, and Ruby was lucky he had Ted. Like, I mean, I think that's what made great jockeys too. Is that they had good coaches.
Didn't even know it, but you did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, Desi was a great mentor for Richie, for Richard, and for Brian, and for lads that came through. Yeah. He was very good with jockeys, and sure, I mean, Ruby is obviously as good as we've seen, but at the same time, I think Ted had a big part of that. So he had his coaching, and like they went through everything together, and that went on the whole way through his career. And like there was nobody more critical about him than Ted was when things didn't go, if he didn't do things right. So it's a huge help to have someone like that.
Moulds you and guides you the right way, especially when things go wrong. That's right.
Yeah. And you and Frank are able to give you that. It has to be a big help. I suppose, to be honest, most good sportsmen have coaches, and they should have, shouldn't they?
Definitely. And that's the way it's going now in the racing game as well. But speaking of days out, you mentioned a horse as well. We've got to talk about Sunshine Street in the Derby. Go there as an outsider. You're a jumps trainer, basically, then.
Yeah, look, Pat Garvey, that owned him, she rode plenty of winners for Pat. He always wanted a Derby horse. So we bought this horse by Sunshine Forever off Timmy Hyde. He was our Derby horse. So like we mightn't have had too many 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds, but he was our Derby horse. But anyway, I never forget Fonzie O'Brien saying to me one day, he says, "Do you realise that you left a horse in the Derby?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "He's my Derby horse." But remember, Vincent, you'd always hear, "Yeah, this is the Derby horse. This is the Derby." I said, "That's my Derby horse." You see, so, and he was a big joke about it. He was the Derby horse. But anyway, he ran a couple of times as a 2-year-old. He was second twice, I think, and then he came out as a 3-year-old, and he was second again, I think, and then we ran him in the Derby trial in Leopardstown. Was he second again?
Was, yes, been a half length, I think.
Second again. I never forget. I was walking out I was walking out, and Michael Clower, remember Michael Clower from South Africa? He was writing for the Sport and Life at the time. And he said to me, coming out, he said, "Where would you be going?" And I said, "I'd be going to Epsom." "Epsom," he says. "Yeah, Epsom." I said, "Isn't that where they're on the Derby?" So anyway, it was all set. We're going to Epsom, and we're all for this then. We're going to Epsom, So about 2 weeks before, I got the heebie-jeebies about it, because Henry Cecil had the best horse he ever had, Michael Stout had the best horse he ever had, Paul Cole, and so on, so on, so on, so on. And Aidan was after winning the French guineas, the English guineas, he had three or four anyway, and he won't be town. He's going to run them all, so he's going to, and it looked like he could be first, second, and third. And I said to Pat, "God, I'm not so sure." So Pat says, "No, we're going now. That's fine anyway. We're going." So then about a week before, Pat rings me and he says, "I was thinking about this." And I said, "No, we're going now. That's it. We're going now. We're definitely going." So anyway, I was thinking to myself, "Sure, there'll be a full field. So we'll beat a good few anyway. We'll beat a few anyway. Whatever, it won't be so bad." Jesus, there's only 12 runners, I think, in the hill, or 13 maybe. And I remember we went over. I sent the horse over. He was a bad traveller. I sent the horse over the week before to Jim Old. He kept him for me. Jim always maintained if he had him for another week, he'd have won the Derby. But anyway, we ended up to have some money. Well, we flew over to the airport there outside, beside Epsom, and stayed in a hotel there. And I got up and I got the Racing Post, and I was reading the Racing Post, and I was going, Jesus. Not one horse in this race that we're sure to beat. I was thinking to myself the whole time. So anyway, we arrive at the races, top hat and tails and the lot, and we're delighted. So Pat arrives anyway, and we heading up to the stable yard to have a look at the horse anyway. And I said to Pat, you know, Pat, I said, there's not one horse in this race we're sure to beat. Ah, don't mind that, we'll be all right. And then he said, you know, he says, I want him ridden positively. I don't want you to be going out there now thinking you have no chance. We're going to bring that. So Johnny's riding him. And there's no more positive man than Johnny anyway. So the whole lot, Johnny's riding the horse. So we had a great day. We had lunch and we were up with the sheikhs and we were having a great day. And Annie would go out to watch the race. And I'm up on the balcony. Actually, it's funny. It's just like as if it was yesterday. And Johnny is going to be positive, so he's handy enough over the first couple of furlongs and the start coming down the hill anyway. And he sort of mooches along anyway, you see, and he goes 5 or 6 clear, and then he's 10 lengths clear into the straight, you see. So I'm watching the rest of the glasses up like this, and I'm watching it. He's about 10 lengths clear, and they're passing the... What's the first one? The 4, is it? Or 3?
After all, yeah.
Past the run, he's 10 minutes there. I started thinking to myself, well, he didn't let us down anyway. He's after running a good race, and he's run a good race anyway. And then the next thing is he's at the 3, and he's still 10 lengths clear now, and he's, you know, he's not going so bad. And I'm starting to shake. We get to the 2 pole now. He mightn't be 10 clear at this stage, but he's still 5 or 6. And the boys behind are driving hard. And I'm starting to go up and down like this. And so we get to the 4-long pole anyway, and we're still in front, and we're still a few lengths in front. And I said, oh, come on, you're at the top rope. And he just got nailed on the line for third by Ursoff in Baldings. And, you know, I was disappointed then because he'd beaten a short head for third. He's only beaten less than 3 lengths. Anyway, we got down, and because the RTE had sent over a crew to cover it, because they thought Aidan was going to be 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Oh. It was going to be Aidan. And Aidan finished 10th, 11th, and 12th. I think they were down there. They ran very bad that particular day, anyway. But Colin Murray, God have mercy on him, was there. And he came running round to me anyway. And he says, God, he says, you ran great. And I said, yeah. You didn't think we brought him over for the fresh air. So I told him like that. I'll never forget Pat Garvey saying to me, he says, hey, God, he says, I've never seen a fellow change his platoon as much as half an hour in my life. it was great. But we had him, we went everywhere with him. He was past, we were in the King, right, he was 5th in the King George. He was 3rd in the English Ledger. And he even went to the Breeders' Cup.
Come to the top of the stretch, and no one has gotten to him yet. Widening the lead, 2 furlongs to go. He leads by 3 lengths as the field turns for home and station of the 2nd. Sunshine Street is set down for the drive 3rd. Here comes Gagley, who's kicking in the middle of the course 4th. Dushy Antur is 5th. Chief Bearhart, too much to do. Final furlong. Bucks Boy trying to cut it out for another 16th of a mile. Gagley is 2nd. Dushy Antur, Sunshine Street, and Chief Bearhart. Here's the line. A wire to wire tour de force on the turf. Shane Sellers.
And funny, one of the biggest mistakes, it was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life and training, when I brought him over to the Breeders' Cup, was that I didn't give him Lasix. Because he breezed the day before, and Johnny was, he absolutely blew them away breezing. And Johnny was absolutely full of him, the way he was. And when he ran in the Breeders' Cup, he ran well now, he finished 5th in the Breeders' Cup. And he just faded in the last 4 long. the following year, now there was no scoping at that time in Ireland. Mm. We were like, we all have our own scopes now. But then there was no scoping. But the following year, he went back to America and he ran in the an invitational race in New York, and he was going to need. He was going to stay in America with Neil Drysdale, and after he ran a good enough race again. But he was fourth or fifth, and Neil had him scoped, and he came back and he told me, he says, "Nolly bled." So I often thought if we'd given him the Lasix in the
what might have been?
Yeah. Mm. Well, look, you don't know. So you'd always think something. You'd always be thinking something that would happen. But I was advised by two very eminent trainers not to give him a Lasix. Their names will remain. We won't talk about who they were.
Of course, Barry Geraghty started off with you as well.
Yeah, well, Barry, of course, was his father, Tucker, and myself were great pals, and his mother and whatever. And sure, I knew Barry growing up all the time. I often stayed in the place when we'd be out hunting or whatever. Sometimes I'd end up and Barry's staying overnight or something like that, you know. But so I knew Barry from early on, and he came. Yeah, Paul was going to ride for Ogden in England. And at the time, I suppose Paul and myself were weren't really getting on that well, and he got the opportunity to go fairly, I think, organised it, that he got to ride for Ogden. So we happened to have, there was a whole gang of us that used to hang around together when we were younger, and we had a kind of a reunion that night, this night, and I said to Tucker, or he said that Barry was going to go to John Fowler, and I said, sure. I said, Paul is going to England. I said, maybe it might be better to come here. And he said, no, he's going to Fowler. And I said, well, sure, whatever. Anyway, he was adamant he was going to John Fowler. So I said, fair enough. So that the following day, anyway, his mother rang. And she said, look, she said, Ross is going to John Fowler. He says, Barry is going to you. So I said, Barry found out, apparently, that I had said to him to come here. So Barry turned the tables around and said, right, no, I'm going to Noel. So he arrived down. And he tells the story himself, but I tell it as well. He arrived down, the first day he arrived down, he got dropped down, and he thought, like, I think he must have thought that he was going to be treated different, but he wasn't really treated any different than anybody else. Or so he says, but he arrived in a pair of tracksuit bottoms and a pair of Doc Martens on him. So anyway, he rode out. So at some stage, I pulled him aside and I said to him, what do you want to be? And he says, I want to be a jockey. And I says, well, I said, if you want to be a jockey, I says, you better look like a jockey. If you look like a jockey, maybe somebody might think you're one someday. So I said, best to get yourself a pair of boots and a pair of jeans or something else. He says, don't come in here. So that was the start. So he looked like a jockey from there on after that.
So it wasn't the perfect of beginnings, shall we say?
Actually, look, it was all right. He was Barry was very dedicated. He was very, very dedicated to what he was doing. And he wouldn't have been much of a sweeper either now, in fairness. He was a quick learner, and he had plenty of pony racing done, so he had a fair idea. Mm. Like, he'd been pony racing for quite a while as a kid, and he knew the ins and outs of what was happening, so it didn't take him long to get to grips with what happened, you know.
When did you realise that Barry was going to be as good as what he turned out to be?
Barry kept telling me.
Fair enough.
It was true.
When did you start agreeing with Barry, though?
I don't know, did we ever agree with him? he just kept telling us anyway that he was. He was different. I remember watching him and creeping into races, you know. Like, I mean, I remember we were in a summer meeting somewhere, I think it might have been Kilbegan or somewhere like that. And I was watching him and he was riding this horse and he just creeping, and he arrived in. Great relationship with a horse called Saving Bond. He won. He won a good few races on him, and I probably we that was his dad and myself fell out over it, or probably for a while anyway, because he broke his collarbone in. He was claiming five at the time. He broke his collarbone about 3 weeks before Galway. The horse was running in the Galway hurdle, and I said he was only going to be back that week, and I said Paul was riding him in the Galway hurdle. And there was what didn't go down very well. But anyway, look, Paul rode him in the Galway hurdle and gave him a terrible ride, as it turned out, because he was after winning the plate the day before. And I don't know what happened that night, but the next
day...
He didn't
sleep anyway.
No. And he gave him a terrible ride. I think if Barry rode him, he would have won. He was finished fourth. And if Barry rode him, he might have won the Galway hurdle. But he was... I know Barry was... Barry was... Always good rider. Got different type of rider than the other guy now, but very strong. I still think Barry was probably, pound for pound, from the last of the line, the strongest rider. Yeah. Because yeah. when he wrapped one of them haymakers behind him, he could make them go. Mm. He was so strong. He was so strong. He was unbelievably strength in his legs and strength in his drive. I think. We don't like to be talking too much about the stick, I suppose, but he had the ability to hit a horse very far back and drive him. I thought, I always thought that, and I suppose you're getting back to Leicester, they used to say that about Leicester, that Leicester was able to hit them so far back that he was able to get them to go forward. But Barry, even with his legs, he was a very, very strong rider.
He used to get those legs back and really get squeeze and kick it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some strength in those legs, wasn't there?
Yeah, and he had a very good racing brain. He had a very good racing brain.
Well, like all the champions, he made Barry was like the rest of them. They made the least mistakes. Made very few mistakes.
That's right. That's right. But through his career now, he was lucky too, which is a big. I tell you, I don't think people sometimes make enough out of that, because in racing, or probably in any sport. You can be lucky. But Barry was lucky as well. Now, I know he was good and all that, and I'm not knocking him at all for this respect, but I'm sure he'd admit it himself. But he just happened to get into the right place at the right time. Like, he got on Moscow, he got on Kicking King, he just happened to bounce. And even at the end, when he got into Nicky's, when, you know, he wouldn't have been running away at the time. Mm. And he got into Nicky's, and then away he went again, and then ending up with JP. Like, I mean, he was lucky. He had a few lucky. Now, maybe you make your own luck, I suppose. Mm. But having said that, now, he did happen to have a few lucky turns. Well, maybe that's...
Oh, no, it's time. And he always seems to just be, excuse me, in the right place at the right time. Yeah. You know, Mick Fitzgerald got...
That's right.
...broke up.
That's right.
Barry's available because he's quiet.
Yeah.
Then away he goes again. You know, he just had that knack of... Yeah. Definitely, but when he got the chance, he definitely made it.
Oh, yeah, no, he didn't miss. But and again, as you say, as I said, maybe, you know, you make your own luck too. But he was, like, I mean, getting on Tom's horse and getting on Kicking King and getting on, like, that was, and Moscow, you know, he was just in the right place at the right time, you know.
And his brother Ross gave you an Irish National winner.
He did.
Tony Boyler.
And fair play to him, he stayed on him at the last. We're talking about Paul and you know, his ability and this, that and the other. He just did not get on with this horse. He was going to win the Tiestas on him and he fell, and he was going to win something else. He fell. Every time he rode him, it was a disaster. But Ross got on him, and in fairness to Ross, you had to just stay quiet on him. And again, I was standing beside Desi Hughes on the stand, and Desi gave me a slap on the back just as he was coming to the last as he won the National. Jesus, he stood on his head. I don't know how he stood up. I don't know how he stayed on him, because he actually put his front head between his front legs. And Ross, of course, was a very good horseman. And he picked him back up off the ground and won the National. It was a fabulous day for me, one of the great days, and great day for Ross, and a great day for Tucker as well. And the whole lot of them to win.
As they race towards the final fence, give over, and the Bunny Boyler on the near side. The Bunny Boyler coming to tackle the over at the final fence. The Bunny Boyler makes the pressure massive, but he's still in front. Give over's in second, winning time. The Bunny staying on in first. They race into the closing stages. The Bunny Boyler, give over, fighting back, but the Bunny Boyler on the near side has the advantage as they go to the line. The Bunny Boyler wins the National. Give over is second and third.
You win the Midlands National a couple of weeks before that.
Yeah, Norman won that. Norman won that, and he was way out of the handicap in it, and he bolted up in that, and then he bolted up in the, and then he won the Irish one. And terrible jumper. Oh my God.
He was horrendous, wasn't he?
Oh, desperate. Like, if you said go to him, he was more likely to put down. He just, if you sort of, you had to sit very quiet on him and whatever, but he was a terrible jumper. But look, he won a couple of good races.
I think I must give you sort of some celebrations around the winning an Irish National Fairy House. What are your local tracks?
Yeah, that was a great day. Yeah, that was a great day. That was one of the big days. Sure, to win an Irish National is, you know, it's probably, I suppose people say about the English National, winning the English National is like better than winning the Gold Cup. I'd rather win the Gold Cup, but at the same time, winning the Irish National was nearly as good as winning the Irish Gold Cup anyway, yeah. You know, and winning the and whatever. But it's a huge race.
You won a Gold Cup last year.
Gold Cup last year. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Think about it there for a second, man, didn't he? He's getting a bit cocky now, right?
No,
trainer.
No, I was trying to think, because there's a Gold Cup you're talking about. Yeah, look, that was a great day, too. I was Helvick. He was after running. It was his fourth run of the season. And he'd run against Broome every time. And the time before that, he finished fourth in the Curragh. And Colin came in and he said, you know, he said, forget about that run altogether. He said, because he hated the ground. He said, and I didn't, he said, I actually didn't knock him around at all. He said, and the day it poured before the Tarsals Gold Cup, the night before, and the ground turned up real soft. And he said to me in the ring before, he says, no, and you know, we give this fella plenty to do today. He says, but he says, don't expect me, he said, to be too early on him. He says, I'm going to have one rattle ham just at the very end, he said. And fair play to him, he did there. He's along with being a very, very, very good rider, he's a most wonderful young man. He's the nicest fella I've come across in racing for a long time.
What makes Colin Keane so good in your opinion?
Well, I suppose he doesn't complicate anything too much, does he? He's just, and he's, I suppose you'd have to say he rides a little bit like a jump jockey, does he? He rolls them around.
He's kind of got a unique...
He's a unique style. Mm. But if we look at jockeys over the years and whatever, and the champion jockeys do come up with their own styles. Like, I mean, whoever would have thought that the style that Pat Eddery had that would work? But it did work.
Kieran Fallon's style.
Kieran Fallon. You know, they were all different. And here's another fella now who's totally different again. And still he's able to conjure that extra little bit out of them by rolling them up the way he does. And the last thing he goes for is a stick.
Yeah. And that day and all, he travels so well. It was an extended 10.5 furlongs as well. He just about gets 10, so the last 100 yards, you had it won, but Broome wasn't lying down.
No, he wasn't. Well, I think he knew that he'd be coming back at him again. Oh, look, it was... I was hoarse after the race, and it was such a pity that it was, because the two lads that own them were such nice fellas, and it would have been fabulous if they were there. But it was such a pity there was nobody there. But look, it was great.
They're long-standing owners of you. Well, they're Finbar, going back from nearly War Golf in Markham, isn't
it? Finbar would be one of my best pals for donkey's years. You know, he owned Pinch Hitter, there was two of them owned Pinch Hitter, but Finbar was the one that. He arrived here. We used to have a party for our owners at Christmas after Navan races. And basically we just had an open house. Now, this room wasn't here, it was that room there. It was a small enough house before that. There's a lot of add-ons since then. And we just have an open house and throw out plenty of drink and plenty of whatever to everybody who was invited, you see. So anyway, everybody was more or less gone at this stage. It was probably 2 in the morning, 3, I don't know what time it was, but it was late anyway. And I said, who's your man in there in the room? And said, I don't know. I thought you knew him. Who invited him? I said, I don't know, I didn't invite him. So that was Finbar. He was at the races, and he ended up coming down to Wilkinstown, and he met a few people, and the next thing is he came on. and we became the best pals. I suppose we were as close to pals as you get for years ever after. And he's still a very good friend of mine, and has horses. Like, it's been lucky. He's a good man to be with in a horse, because he's been lucky as well. Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, he's had a horse called Dadu's Dart, who ended up going to Australia. Mm. He had a filly called Wing in It, and all these didn't cost a lot to buy, but they ended up being sold for quite a lot of money. Yeah. So they were kind of that. Another one in between, I thought, another one as well. And now he has Elvic Dream. So, and none of them were expensive horses, you know, they just worked out well. So he's lucky. Which is a help.
And Noel, on that last year Tattersall's Gold Cup Group 1, the whole thing has come full circle again. I know the Devon's coaching won a greater race than Avon today, but you're nearly back on the flat as much or not more than you are over jumps.
Yes, Fran, well, basically it's the reverse situation. Go to the Derby sale, you're talking in terms of minimum 50. You know, to buy a three-year-old, to wait for minimum 12 months to get there, and minimum 50. Like, you're only buying, you're buying something very much down the line, less than that. So that's been, and then go up the step further, the horse wins the point-to-point, you're talking about 250. And it's very, very difficult to compete with that. It's very, like, I mean, unless you have a multimillionaires, you can't buy these horses. They're just out of the way. Now, look, money doesn't always buy them, but I've always maintained he who wins in the sale ring is going to win on the track. Yeah. And that's what's going to happen.
Over time.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, that's why Ballydoyle are very hard to beat, because they have the best pedigrees and they have the best horses. So, naturally enough, they're going to be very hard to beat. And the same thing now with the jumpers. If Willie is buying so many of the top horses, Gordon, Henry, you know, those 3 yards alone are full of very expensive horses. So it's very hard to compete with that. So for the last couple of years, with Giggenstown winding down, our buying power has been cut back. And I, there now, a little bit by accident, I started to buy a few flat horses. Mm. And they were lucky, and they turned into good money. And so I said, why not do a bit more of that? So the people we were buying them for sort of enjoyed it, and we got a few more. So this year now, I've bought, for the last couple of years, I've bought very few jumping horses. Mm. And I've bought a lot more flat horses. And of course, the other thing about flat horses, if you have flat horses, you could still have a jumper. Because if he's slow, he could still be a jumper.
Jeff Kibber, your most recent Cheltenham Festival winner.
Absolutely. Whereas if you have a slow jumper, the next step is a hunter. Do you know? So that, it's a different, you know. So you're investing.
It doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't add up. So you're investing your own money. The flat one, I said. Yeah. And look, you say, for instance, you spend the 50 or the 60 or 100 or whatever on a three-year-old store. He needs to be an absolute machine to be worth 250, 300, 400, you know, that sort of money. You could spend 50 on a flat horse. He could be worth a million, you know. The flat horse has the whole, is a worldwide commodity. Like, you have the Far East, the Middle East, the Hong Kong, America, Australia. Everywhere. That horse can go there. So that's basically. Now, I'd love to be able to go and keep buying the jumpers as well, but at the prices they're making, it's, you see, there's not that many people around there with that sort of money to go and spend. You know, there are the few, and but as I say, that's
question for you regards Willie and Gordon. You were champion trainer over jumps, what, 7 times. Was that hard to take when Willie took over the mantle off you? Because obviously you're hugely ambitious, hugely driven, hugely hungry. Did it grate on you that you couldn't compete at Willie to the same extent as you used to?
Ah, yes, of course it did. Of course it did. Originally, yes, it would have. It would have. Then after a while, I think I got to the stage. I think it's a tough business to be. Like it was very hard going, because you went from one year to the next, and you're just driven. Your life actually gets overtaken by it, and to keep doing it, you have to nearly forget about everything else, and you just have to keep doing it. Now, it just overtakes you. And I not kind of in a way, as far as competing for championships, I'm kind of glad I'm not on that treadmill anymore, because it's just very difficult. It's a bit like, I'm sure AP would have kept riding for a lot longer had he got beaten at some stage in the championship. You know, but the fact that he didn't get beaten, he couldn't afford to keep riding and get beaten. He knew if he was going to ride, he was going to have to ride at the top of his game. So if he had to ride at the top of his game, he was going to have to do what he was doing. He was going to have to keep doing what he was doing. And that was, I'd say that just couldn't work out for him. He just couldn't do that. But I'd say if he hadn't been sort of, that seems a strange thing to say, but if he wasn't as successful, he probably would have stayed going longer. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's stupid.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
I think he probably would. But Willie seems very comfortable at it. He certainly seems to be comfortable, very comfortable doing it. And as I say, that's down to delegation, I suppose. But he does seem to be very comfortable at it. But behind the scenes, it can't be easy, because I know that when you're training horses and that. There's plenty of bad days with injuries, and especially jumpers. Like, I mean, that's the killer with jumpers, is injuries. And that takes it out of you a bit now, when you have to go back to talk to them. Because when you spend a lot of money on horses and you have to go and tell somebody, sorry, or he's out for the year or worse, you know, it's hard on you.
And nobody, at the end of the day, you're all horse people. Nobody likes to see a horse getting injured, no matter how long you're doing it. It never gets easy, does it?
No. Oh, God, no. It never gets easy. That's the killer, isn't it? That is the killer. Like, injuries are what really knocks you for six. You know, it's, and then, you know, trying to tell people about them. You know, you sort of, that's what makes it tough.
What's on the wish list?
Well, I definitely hope that Nina wins the dancing.
As we all do.
The wish list. I just hope I'm able to stay healthy and be able to, as the fella says, I'm not going to win any more championships, but I'd like to win some good races. You'd love to think that you're going to win the Champion Hurdle and the Gold Cup someday, but look, your chances of them are harder every year. But I'm not going to beat myself up over anything other than the fact that I hope I can stay healthy and keep winning races. As you probably know, I'm a big Meath football fan. And years ago, the first round of the championship, Meath played Dublin. And four times, they drew three times and then eventually beat them by a point the last day. And they were getting beat the last day. And the fella who was playing cornerback, Kevin Foley, came up the field, brought the ball with him, passed over back, bang, scored a goal. Kevin, the only goal he ever scored in his life, I think, certainly on a county team. Anyway, the next thing, the ball was kicked out and Jinxie Beggy got and kicked it over the bar. And I was absolutely, there was five or six of us on the stand, and I was in absolute... euphoria over this, you know, it's probably the best. And to be honest with you, it was the best. It was unbelievable. I still can remember that moment when all that happened. But Michael Flower was doing an article of the time Tiananmen Square was going to Cheltenham, and You know, Michael, as I say, he's from South Africa, and he was, you know, an awfully nice fellow, Michael. Now, he really was. But I suppose, I shouldn't say that, but he, in some ways, in Irish life, he was a little bit innocent. Would you, did you remember him?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm.
A little bit innocent about Irish life.
He was 78, I think, on was he? Today. Or yesterday.
Lovely man. Lovely man. But anyway, we were sitting in there in the other room, and he was doing the article, and he says to me, and he says, now he says, what was your greatest moment? He said, what was your greatest moment? Oh, it says, I Foley's gold. And he looked at me and he says, I don't remember that horse now, Noel. Where did that horse? Foley's gold still stands out in my mind, you know. I'll never forget Kevin Foley scoring that goal. Or that to me was, that was one of the greatest days. And it was only the first round of the championship. But anyway, there you go.
Noel, 50 years on, no, you go racing every day of your runner, basically. You rarely miss one of your horse running. Your enthusiasm for the game, training and life, you always think young, you're always on the go. It's good to see.
That's the dancing, you see.
We're going to come to that, yeah.
That's going to be the final act, actually.
You're right, Fran. I love racing. I like going racing. Sometimes getting your goat a bit and you sort of think to yourself, oh, thank God, I don't have to go today and this, that and the other. And then the next thing is you're out in the gallops and something works well and you say, that's in on Saturday now, that has a good chance of going well and you can't wait to go racing. And then I love the people I meet racing. Like, I mean, all my friends are racing. And so, like, you know, it's like a big happy family. Well, maybe it's not happy all the time, but it's like a big family, isn't it?
It is.
Really. Mm. And I, like, you have your pals, I have my pals, and we'd meet each other and have a bit of crack, and you know, always have a bit of banter one way or the other. And there's a whole lot, like, there's fellas there that, Jesus, what would I do if I couldn't meet Gordon and Paul Nolan and, like, a whole lot of other lads that are maybe Edo and a few more. But like, you enjoy the crack with them and you enjoy the bit of gas and so there's always a bit of scandal going on and something this, that and the other and you have a bit of a laugh. And sure, it's a way of life, really, isn't it? I enjoy it anyway. I enjoy life anyway.
We all make a living out of our hobby, don't we?
That's exactly the racing.
And there's very few people working in jobs that actually say they're making a living out of their hobby, but we can say that.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. No, it's the staff situation is probably just annoys me a little bit at the moment. But besides the staff, everything else is good, you know. And as long as I can stay healthy and well, I hope I'll be able to keep doing it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a really proper trip down memory lane. Plenty of work to still do, Noel.
Oh, plenty of work still to do, yeah. Plenty of work. Oh, well, it's nice to have you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.